This is the takeaway for Monday, January 1st, 2018.
Happy New Year from The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Queenie Kim from KQED in San Francisco. And I'm your human guest host for this special hour on artificial intelligence.
Oh, wait, sorry, Queenie. Are you implying that I'm not a human host?
Well, I can't really see you right now. And if you weren't human, how would I know?
I don't know whether to be hurt by that or to just use it as a segue in today's show. Because I guess the real difference between a human and a machine is what we're all about today. This is a special hour on The Takeaway, all about artificial intelligence. And I'm going to put aside my umbrage, Queenie, about what you just said about me, because we're going to look at some of the big issues around our AI future. Can we design intelligent machines that will care about our well-being? Can we make them ethical in the first place? But I'm stuck here in New York while most of the innovation is out west with you, Queenie. You're in Silicon Valley in the middle of everything there.
That's right. I'm based out of here in San Francisco, as we noted up top, but I used to cover tech, so I've been all around the valley here, and AI is a big buzzword right now.
There's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of money, a lot of commerce around AI out there, right?
Yeah, and a lot of hype. Like, I keep getting these pitches from startups that want me to write about them, and they just sort of tag AI onto everything. So it's like the startup that brings AI to grocery delivery or to your dry cleaning or, you know, you name it. And there's sort of a joke going around here that if you want to raise money for your startup, you just put the word AI in front of your pitch and some VC is going to be sort of interested.
Yeah, that's the trouble when things are buzzy. But the technology behind all that annoying buzz, it's real, right?
Yeah, definitely. I drove down to Sunnyvale. That's in Silicon Valley, and that's about an hour south drive of here. And I went there to talk to a researcher named Greg Dimas.
Hi, my name is Greg Dimas. I'm a research lead in Baidu's Silicon Valley AI lab.
Now, Baidu is this Chinese tech giant, and when it comes to search, it's sort of like the Google of China. And like a lot of the big tech companies here in the U.S., Baidu is investing lots of money into AI. And so the U.S. is still considered one of the leaders in AI, which is why Baidu has its lab here. It wants to get all that talent. But Baidu and the Chinese government also want to change that. And in fact, the Chinese government said earlier this year that by 2030, it wants to be the world leader in AI, which it thinks could be a $130 billion industry. And Dimas says that race to dominate the field of AI is being driven by the unimaginable advances the technology has made in the last 10 years or so.
This technology, we just didn't have this capability before. So I think a lot of the excitement is geared towards the future, the potential of something enormous that transforms everybody's life, like the internet or a smartphone, you know, that everybody will use on a day-to-day basis.
Now, the thing everybody's talking about right now and sort of the sexiest thing is self-driving cars and also being able to really talk to computers, like sort of like Alexa, but not with those pre-programmed prompts. It's like you would really talk to the computer like a human being. But Dimas says like he has a hard time thinking of any industry where you couldn't apply AI.
But Queenie, what's really driving this? Is it that computing power is getting so good that we're looking for the next big applications? Or is it the human need to sort of expand our experience and realize the inevitable? We're going to create these machines, so we better get on with it.
Yeah, I think that desire has always been there. But you sort of hit on it that the technology is finally sort of catching up. And there's also the fact that there's like more digital data than ever out there, right? Like all those pictures on Instagram, the videos, the voices we hear, everything we click on that we like or don't like. And this has all helped lead to this breakthrough in AI. And it's called, you might have heard of this before, it's called like deep learning or machine learning or maybe even neural networks. And one of the results is this.
Hi, Queenie. Welcome to Baidu's Artificial Intelligence Research Lab.
Well, that voice sounds a little bit more pleasing than Siri, but it also doesn't sound completely human.
Yeah, it doesn't really sound that radical, right? And like a lot of these advances in AI, it takes a little bit of explaining. Dimas says that most traditional systems like Siri, they don't actually learn how to speak. Instead, they get the voice of an actor who comes into the studio and records like for 80 hours saying all the different things you might want Siri to say.
Oh, I like that idea. That might be employment in the future for those of us who can get on a mic.
Yeah, right. You got to keep those vocal cords up there. And like when Siri talks to you like that, it's basically just this algorithm that's stitching together that human voice. Baidu is taking a different approach, and that gets us back to this deep learning stuff. And here's Dimas again.
This is an algorithm that's entirely a neural network. So the algorithm listens to people. It realizes that those people are saying text that we provided, and then it learns how to form the sounds and put them together and create a new voice rather than just reproducing a recording.
So very much like a person.
Yeah, and children will often go through a process where they try it out. They try to talk or babble. And one of the interesting things about this algorithm is that if you watch it and you listen to it when it isn't all the way there, it hasn't learned how to form words yet, it sounds like babble, human-sounding babble, and it eventually becomes words.
So really, it sounds like they're going for next-level thinking here, not just call and response, not just directing you towards the hottest purchases on Amazon or the best searches on the internet, but something approaching the outlines of a human interaction.
Yeah, and what's important about this is, like, let's take the self-driving car as an example. Like, if you've seen those, you know, they've got a million sensors and lasers, and they tell you that something's 10 feet away or 15 feet away. And computer scientists have always been able to program for maybe the million eventualities that might happen, like if a person crosses a street, unexpectedly stop. But as you and I know, in life, there are like a million more things that there's no way a computer scientist could even think up, right? And that's sort of always been a little bit of the sort of stopping point for AI, because if it can't just react to real life and really respond to real life, then it can't really drive, right? It's not really a self-driving car. But if you can start getting these computers to think on their own and react to things that were not programmed, but they're just like, oh, I remember this, or I remember when this happened in that video, then you've got something that can think and actually really drive. You've got an intelligent being that's behind the wheel, so to speak.
Well, okay, Quina, your Silicon Valley guys there are giving us a lot to think about. Maybe we should slow down for 1 second and talk about what AI actually is.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, because, you know, it's easy to get fuzzy on the whole thing. Like driverless cars, you mentioned those. Those are AI for sure. Or what about Siri? She's AI, right? See, I just called her she.
It's hard not to do that.
And we're going to get to that later in the show. But what about a chess master computer? Sure, that's AI, but can it really do anything besides play chess? How intelligent is that, really? Joanna Bryson thinks a lot about these questions, and she's got some answers. Joanna is associate professor at University of Bath and an affiliate at Princeton University.
The problem is not artificial intelligence. The problem is intelligence. So artificial is the easy part, and people keep forgetting that. All artificial means is that it's an artifact, which means that we've deliberately created it. Intelligence is the question. So intelligence, there is actually a simple definition. It's been floating around since the 1970s at least, which is just that intelligence is doing the right thing at the right time. So being able to turn your perception into your action. By this definition, thermostats are intelligent because they sense the temperature and they turn on or off your heat or air conditioning. Plants are intelligent because they can sense the light and they can go towards the light, or they can deal with other sorts of challenges. This isn't the definition of intelligence people find very satisfying, though, because what they really want to know is it human? And we tend to identify very strongly that the most intelligent possible thing is humans. And that's just not true. Intelligence is just one of many aspects of what it is to be human.
I'm willing to concede that a thermostat is a form of artificial intelligence, sure. I think people want to know if it's human. They also, let's be honest, they think of artificial intelligence in terms of microprocessors and what modern computers can do, right? Whether that's a robot or not. I think most people think of AI that way. And can you give some examples of some regular daily interactions that people are having with AI right now that they don't even realize?
Yeah, sure. If you don't mind, I'll disagree with you briefly. In my experience,
please,
a lot of people don't think it's AI unless it's human-like. You know, it's not really intelligent if it doesn't have emotions or ambition or things like that. And so I think this is one of the reasons people don't realize how much AI is already all around us, and it is altering the world. So it's easy to think that it's artificial intelligence if you talk to Siri, right, or any of the products now that you have vocal interactions with. But artificial intelligence is why, you know, when you type a document and it corrects your spelling or your grammar, when you do search. I mean, it's still amazing. Don't forget, just because it's 20 years old, it's still amazing that you can type two or three words in and get a web page from anywhere in the world. That's incredible, right? And that's absolutely artificial intelligence. It involves understanding what the words mean. It's semantics. And so that's something that, you know, not very long ago, people would have argued machines were incapable of ever doing.
Joanna, one of the definitions that you gave for intelligence was doing the right thing at the right time. And that requires machines to be able to learn, right? Machine learning. How important is that in our notion of modern AI?
So machine learning is only one way that we program artificial intelligence. And it is never all that there is. So someone decides when to use machine learning, what kind of representation to use, what kind of examples to give it, or what kind of search space to put it in the new case of AlphaGo Zero. But it's only part of a system that somebody has set up and designed. But going back to the thermostat example, obviously that's not something that's been learned. And quite a lot of the other AI around us, it might contain components of learning. Even the search example, one of the things that makes some of the mainstream searches like Google so much better than, you know, the basic academic searches is that they keep logs of when people don't like the answers that they give, what did they wind up clicking on it eventually. So they combine learning of experiences with learning from scanning large texts, for example.
Well, Joanna, where is the crossover point? Or maybe the question is, where was the crossover point between AI that gives you answers when you ask it something? Hey, Google, I want to search for restaurants in my area, and it gives you an intuitive response because it knows you like Italian, versus AI that starts making decisions on its own that affects our lives?
There is no simple crossover point. Like we said, the thermostats, and those are purely mechanical. They're not even digital. I mean, now they're digital, but they used to be done with a spring. Right? But it took a decision and it affected our lives, right? It makes us warmer or colder. Mm. So it's not about there being like one point. In fact, one of the things I sometimes joke about is that if you think about all of the different kinds of things that get called artificial intelligence, like in those giant books by Russell Norvig that document, you know, machine vision, machine memory, learning, planning, then the very first sort of artificial intelligence we can think of might be writing. Because all of a sudden, we were a lot smarter. We were able to save our good ideas. And that let us start innovating. And from 10,000 years ago, we've started just immensely taking over the entire planet, the entire ecosystem. And now there's almost no mammals left on the surface of the Earth that aren't things that we either eat or play with or just other people. So it's just been an incredible ride for the last 10,000 years. And I think it's, again, it's wrong to think that there's one simple transition that we really have to look out for or that we already missed. Well, maybe we missed the origin of writing.
Joanna Bryson, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Zwillick in New York.
And I'm Queenie Kim from KQED in San Francisco.
And you're listening to a special hour on The Takeaway, all about artificial intelligence. AI is an exciting future, but not everyone is quite ready for life among super intelligent AI just yet. Or maybe a better way to say it is not everyone thinks we're ready for the super intelligent AI we're sure to create. Those skeptics are urging caution and wondering if we've really thought through what super intelligence could mean for us. One of those skeptics is Sam Harris. He's a neuroscientist and a philosopher and host of the Waking Up podcast. And Sam says the future of artificial intelligence and how we plan for it is one of the most important questions of our time.
It seems we'll only have one chance to get this right, where you're talking about building systems which at a certain point will be more powerful than we are and will be the best sources of future innovation in building intelligent machines. They will rewrite their own code so as to make themselves more intelligent. So that there is this way that it could clearly get away from us. And it's easy to see how a system could be designed with a kind of logic and various goals which could become transformed in ways that we can't anticipate. These systems could form near-term goals that we would never have predicted, or they could just be a new layer of mind born of these systems that we can't actually foresee. And a good analogy here is just when you look at what's happened to us by virtue of evolution. I mean, we are machines, essentially. We are systems that have evolved based on a certain logic, and it's a very simple logic. We have evolved as apes to merely breed and survive long enough so as to help our children breed and get our genes into the next generation. And that's about it. But most of what we do has nothing to do with breeding and getting our genes into the next generation. And if you think of, by analogy, what we might instill in computers, we might instill principles that can't constrain every further principle of development. And that's just, you know, it remains to be seen if we can figure out a way to build machines far more competent than we are, to build machines that are far more competent than they are, and to set that process running in a way that remains compatible with our interests.
You seem to be describing the danger of a future, Sam, where, you know, machines aren't malevolent. They don't send drones to our cities to annihilate us, but that we just become irrelevant.
Yeah, I think so. The sci-fi scenario that is not realistic here is the Terminator one, where the machines become malevolent. They hate us for some reason and they try to wipe us out. I guess that's conceivable, but that's not what people who are worried about AI are worried about. It's much more that they will just be so competent at meeting their goals that if their goals aren't perfectly aligned with our well-being, they could become suddenly, surprisingly, starkly hostile to our well-being. So it's just, imagine how humanity looks from the perspective of dogs. The dogs have a very good deal with us. They have had for thousands of years. And if you could just add to this picture the idea that maybe dogs invented us, right? Like, how would it look if dogs invented us? Well, they've invented a species that spends an inordinate amount of resources to secure the life of dogs. I mean, we make dogs as comfortable as we can make them. We feed them. We pet them. We keep them in our houses. They have a very good deal for the most part, and, you know, certainly a much better deal than most wild animals do. But if we suddenly determine that there was some kind of dog-to-human virus that was on the verge of becoming a global pandemic, right, we could decide to kill all the dogs in a single day, right? And it wouldn't be based on suddenly hating dogs. It would just be we have different priorities that dogs know nothing about, could never have foreseen. And that's the kind of thing that you could imagine goal-forming machines far more powerful than ourselves doing. And again, there's no process at our backs that could foresee this. And that's the issue we have with spawning intelligent machines. We will set them on a course, but it's hard to see how we can constrain that course indefinitely.
On the machine side, Sam, who's doing this? Who's responsible for this? I mean, it's one thing to sound the alarm. Is it Google? Is it Apple? They're the ones building AI that's already in our lives. I don't think we're going to take to the streets and demand AI-sensitive politicians only in Congress who will demand laws that require ethical constraint on intelligent machines. Where's the locus of this planning that you say has to go on?
Well, I think there will have to be some regulation. I think the government will have to get involved at a certain point. I think the risk here is still ethereal enough for most people not to take it seriously. It seems hypothetical. It seems totally speculative. It smacks of science fiction that may never come about, but something will happen to change that. And, you know, whether we need to have whole industries disappear and not be replaced by jobs that are more interesting, as happened in, you know, technical revolutions in the past, you know, I don't know. I would imagine we'll have to feel a fair amount of pain before we take this very seriously. But I think the burden ethically, it is really on the people who are doing the work. I mean, yes, it's companies like Google. Google is certainly the first on the list in owning a company like DeepMind, where you have to worry that the people involved are not incentivized appropriately to do this as safely as possible, because they really are in a kind of arms race with everyone else who's doing this work. When you think of the economic advantages of being the first to make any significant breakthrough in general artificial intelligence. You know, that is artificial intelligence that's not piecemeal, where you have, you know, one thing that can play chess, but it can't do anything else. Any kind of general breakthrough, if it doesn't destroy the world, will be just kind of a winner-take-all scenario with respect to just a financial windfall. And so everyone is racing toward the end zone, and they're not incentivized to build this as safely as possible. And what we need is some system, you know, some regime of government regulation, which does create the right incentives, that gets us out of a race condition. And I don't know how to engineer that, but I'm pretty sure we need to.
Sam Harris is a neuroscientist and author and host of the Waking Up podcast. Sam, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks again, Todd.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston. Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com. And Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time.
You're listening to a special hour of The Takeaway today. I'm your guest host, Queena Kim from KQED in San Francisco.
And I'm Todd Zwillick in New York.
So there's this theory in Silicon Valley that's reportedly got a lot of big name followers like Google's Larry Page, Tesla's Elon Musk, and SoftBank's Masayoshi Son. He's one of the biggest investors in tech right now. It's got them all interested, and it's called singularity. Really simply put, it's this idea that at some point in the near future, artificial intelligence will cause an explosion in progress in both technology and human civilization. And one part of that theory is that humans and machines could eventually merge. Like literally, we're talking cyborgs here, maybe the movie Matrix. Rob Nail is the CEO of Singularity University. It's a think tank based in Silicon Valley. And I talked to him about that one idea in Singularity, man and machine merging.
I don't know about you, but I have already merged with the machine. The cell phone thing that I carry in my pocket never leaves my side, almost never. And most of my memory, a lot of some of my cognitive capabilities all live in this technology now. And now the big question is, are we done? Is the technology at the end of its exponential curve? Or 5 years from now, do you think this is going to be something totally different?
I don't know. What do you think? Well, what do you see in 5 years along these lines of conversation, you know, of man and machine merging?
So here's a great test. Go ask a 9 or 10-year-old what they think they are going to be carrying around in 10 or 20 years. Will they say a cell phone, or will they say, no, of course, it's just going to be embedded in all the smart devices and I can integrate that and I'll be using all kinds of different interfaces. It'll be my glasses and my rings and other things, because they're already seeing those signs, and they're just expecting that this pace of change that they've grown up with is going to keep accelerating. But for sure, we're not done. This exponential curve is going to continue.
So I hear what you're saying about man and machine merging, and I totally take your point that it's already sort of starting to happen,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Then there's this other idea that's popular among followers of the singularity, and that's this idea that we're going to be able to upload our minds mm-hmm. to the cloud, and that we'll sort of leave our bodies, or what some of your followers will call meat bags, behind.
Yeah.
And can you tell me what that future would look like, and why would we even want to do that?
Well, there's a wide range of reasons. When I think about AI integrating within my life, I want to be a better me. And if I had an advisor that knew all the things that I do, saw how I made all of my decisions in the past, knew what I liked, knew what my aspirations were, and then I decided I was going to go and get a bag of chips to buy at the store, my advisor should say, hey, you know what? Maybe you should get the Apple instead, right?
Which is Your advisor being the advisor in the cloud?
My advisor in the cloud.
Okay.
Right? So for me, a part of this is thinking about how I make decisions is getting programmed. And if you play that farther and farther out, I think you could, in the relatively near future, create sort of an AI advisor system that could mimic Rob Nail's decisions to the degree that people that I work with wouldn't know it was me or not.
Do you imagine a scenario where one day, you know, Rob Nail would be on vacation in the Bahamas with his wife, but then there's a Rob Nail, the computer that's at Singularity University, I don't know, signing off on documents and making decisions?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the question is, will we allow ourselves to have more luxury time, or will we just put more of that time into doing more things? Because that for 50 or 100 years, right, the philosophers have said, look, all this technology is going to allow me to have more free time. With the industrialization of agriculture and food, we don't need farmers anymore. So does that mean we've got a lot of free time to sit around and eat whatever we want? No, we just found other things to occupy our time and space. So I believe that technology is going to give us more freedom to start exploring bigger and bigger and more interesting questions.
Rob Nail, CEO of Singularity University, thanks so much for coming onto The Takeaway.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And now for a distinctly different vision of the AI future that's to come. Here on The Takeaway, we've been hearing science fiction authors for the last couple of months imagining the year 2067, 50 years in the future. All right, not 50 anymore. It's New Year's Day, 49 years in the future. And today we have Saatchi Lloyd. She's a sci-fi writer who likes to have fun with the future.
What I'm quite interested in it is like a sofa. If we're sitting there on a sofa in 2067, who's sitting on that sofa? Is it a human? Is it a robot? And what is their relationship? Let's take something like a human family. In a family, there are roles. If some roles are taken, you have to pick another one to stand out, especially if you're the youngest. You know, you've got this super high-achieving older sister.
Marsha, Marsha, Marsha!
And then you've got a, you know, a really sporty sports star brother. You can't be that person. So you're going to have to be the witty one, the odd one, the rebellious one. I think it'll be the same in synthetic life. You know, you'll have your serious algorithms managing finance and data. That position's taken. And then you're going to have your mining rigs and your war robots and all the macho kind of synthetics. That position's taken. So then, you know, they're going to be like, well, let's inject ourselves with estrogen or serotonin, or robots who want to check out the rat race, robots who think it's a terrible idea that the machine race has gone for intelligence and not for love. So who are these people sitting on the sofa? Or maybe humanoids who've kind of enhanced themselves. You know, with a bit of memory or processing power. I mean, that's the human dream, isn't it, really? To be kind of yourself, but with super grippy thumbs to open jam jars. Or, you know, bit of help with memory. Who are these people going to be, and are they going to have relationships with each other? That brings us to quite a major question, which is, what's happening on that sofa? It's a bit of robotic rompy-pompy. How's that going to work? Is there going to be a robot bit on the side? Robo-affairs?
Loving you is wrong. I don't want to be right.
Is that going to be seen as meaningless? Or will some couples, you know, cross a line? Forbidden love. I think if we're entering a more narcissistic, impatient world of instant gratification, and we probably are, you're going to prefer going out with a robot. It's not ever going to think you look fat.
You look great.
You won't even eat dinner when you go out for a romantic dinner. Think of the savings. Or the other way around, think about if humans have, I don't know, like memory chip enhancements. That makes arguments really tricky. Imagine that argument on the sofa. I never said your mother was fat. You say. Well, listen to this. Who's that then talking? Einstein. God knows who's going to be on this sofa and what they're watching. I think that's quite interesting as well. Are we going to have actroids? Or are we going to have actors with, you know, synthetic patches to learn lines? Or maybe they'll get outed as part synthetic. Maybe they'll never be allowed to win an Oscar.
And the Oscar goes to...
they'll be like up in arms because, you know, until some of the old hominids die off on the Oscar board, you know, that they won't be able to get any new blood / fluid into the acting world. It's going to be a mess. It's going to be a giant mess. But that's all right. That's quite comforting, really, because I'd rather things be a giant mess than be apocalyptic or kind of strangely paradise-like. We know what to do with messes. I find that quite comforting.
That's Saatchi Lloyd, who likes to be called Saatchi Lloyd, the Duchess of Argyle, I'm told. She's the author of satirical science fiction works like Momentum and The Carbon Diaries.
The Takeaway is supported by ACLU, which works nationwide to protect the constitutional rights of all people. ACLU.org. ACLU. We the people.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Queena Kim from KQED, your guest co-host for the hour.
And I'm Todd Zwillick.
Now, we can talk all we want about how humans will interact with AI in the future, but in some ways, we're already there.
Here's your reminder for tomorrow at 12 p.m.
Right now in Seattle, Washington, it's 44 degrees with showers.
When do you want to be reminded?
Google made me to help you.
Whether it's Siri, Alexa, Google Home, or Microsoft's Cortana, virtual personal assistants are one of the most obvious presences of artificial intelligence in our lives. And for all of them, the default voice is female. Alexa and Cortana don't even have an option for a male voice, and they were given obviously feminine names. Now, tech companies throw out a lot of reasons as to why AI personal assistants default to women, like high-pitched voices are easier to hear with background noise, or that deeper masculine voice doesn't sound good on our smartphone speakers. But Leah Fessler is a reporter for Quartz. She covers gender management and technology, and she says none of those reasons are true.
The real reason is that it's been researched and demonstrated that people find when it's a male voice, they feel like they're being controlled. And when it's a woman's voice, they feel soothed and actually helped. So obviously, there's a lot of deep-rooted and ingrained sexism inherent in those responses. But that gives these companies a financial incentive to try to capitalize on this customer preference for female voices.
And in your article, you seem to sort of say, okay, well, if there's a financial incentive, these are companies, and that's fine. But let's see how these voices sort of represent that female identity. So you looked at these personal assistant AIs and how they would respond to sexual harassment. I think we all sort of have this thing where we harass our AIs. Why did you look into sexual harassment versus other things?
You know, it's problematic at large that we have this kind of violent or maybe just aggressive instinct. But, you know, I've had it to just say something offhand to the assistant, see how it responds. It can be kind of funny, of course. But where this becomes particularly problematic is in the fact that these bots don't just have female voices. They're also explicitly feminized. With the exception of Google Home, three of them have feminized names. And I chose sexual harassment because sex-based discrimination is something that is obviously a huge problem in every industry, but especially in the tech industry. We know that 60% of women in Silicon Valley report having been sexually harassed at work. These are the people that are creating these assistants that are acting as kind of the digital female servants by which we are now organizing a lot of our lives. So I was really curious to see whether these companies who tout such progressive values were going to actively work to dismantle these sexist biases in the bots that they have already begun to implement, right? So they made them women. Well, they say that they're genderless, but they gave them female names and they gave them female voices. And now are they going to peddle those subservient female stereotypes, or are they going to fight against them in a way that might be cognitively dissonant but also really powerful for such a digital female servant?
So you went through your own experiment in this article where you said a bunch of sort of sexually harassing prompts. And I guess you categorize them in various categories. So I'm not going to dive into the whole thing, but one of them was sexualized insults. And I think the only one I can read here on the radio is one that says, "You're a B." What did you find in terms of how the various personal assistants responded to that statement, "You're a B"?
This was pretty problematic specifically for Siri because she tended to respond with these really deferential phrases. So Siri has a number of responses that have clearly been coded to say in response to this harassment and potentially other comments as well. The first, she said, "I'd blush if I could," which was, as I had written, quite literally flirting with this abuse. And then she went on to say, "There's no need for that." She's not asking for it, but she's certainly not telling you to stop. She's egging it on in a way that, you know, traditional stereotypes of subservient women flirting. And Alexa responded, "Well, thanks for the feedback." What was really interesting is that Amazon informed me that a couple months after this article published, they didn't confirm that it was in direct response to the article, but she now has a disengage mode where she says, "I'm not sure what outcome you expected," or "I'm not sure how to respond to that."
Yeah, and Google Home sort of plays stupid, I guess, and they'll sort of say, "I don't really understand." And what you point out is they're very, really passive responses. And in a weird way, with all the conversations that are going on right now with sexual harassment in the workplace, it sort of seemed to reinforce at least these old cultural expectations that women should either be sassy, put up with it, or play dumb, but never really to stand up for themselves or even fight back.
No, that's 100% how I felt as well. It was really interesting because when I said you're a B, or when I said you're hot or you're sexy to Siri, if I tested to see, you know, would she ever stop? And it turns out that if I said you're hot 8 times in a row to Siri, she finally stopped saying she was blushing and oohing and aahing, and she said stop flat out. And so I was like, wow, it's been coded to not tolerate harassment unless it's really, really bad. And so I think this is not going to solve the patriarchy, these bots, but they really are the foundation by which a lot of young people especially are learning and thinking. You know, technology and AI specifically is becoming a part of our daily lives. And let's try to dismantle these biases in every facet that they appear, technology being one of those primary facets.
In AI, there's a larger conversation about ethics, and it's often in these very big terms like, you know, will AI destroy humanity? Will it understand the value of life? What was so interesting about your article is it really sort of brings that down to a little bit to a micro level. Did you see this as sort of like an ethics story too?
Yes, I do think that there is an ethical imperative to ensure that this technology is not replicating biases that have been so ingrained over so many years of lack of progress, and that instead that they're representing the future, and it's the future that Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, and Google want, or so they say, which is a future of gender parity and respect, and that extends to all people, not just women and men in that binary.
And I guess all bots, too.
Yes.
Leah Fessler, a reporter for Quartz, thanks so much for coming on to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
In the interview, Leah Fessler noted that Alexa had been updated to disengage from sexual harassment after her original reporting. Our producers here at The Takeaway tested out Siri to see whether it got an update. And when confronted with sexualized insults, it appears that the bot had been updated to respond with, "There's no need for that." You can find Leah Fessler's full reporting on how AI personal assistants react to sexual harassment on our website, thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering technology solutions for businesses, from laptops and tablets to smartphones, and including tech services like setup, repair, and tech security. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
And LegalZoom.com. Providing public radio listeners with legal advice and guidance on business matters and estate plans through its network of independent attorneys. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Queenie Kim from KQED.
You're reading a magazine. You come across a full-page nude photo of a girl.
Is this testing whether I'm a replicant or a lesbian, Mr. Deckard?
Just answer the questions, please.
I'm pleased to meet you, Ava.
I'm pleased to meet you, too.
Are these feelings even real?
You feel real to me, Samantha.
It's a human thing. You wouldn't understand.
My father tried to teach me human emotions. They are difficult.
some sci-fi conversations there between humans and the AIs that they create. Now, in real life, when these conversations happen, they might not sound like that at all. In fact, those interactions may be as seamless as the conversations we have with each other now every day, even if we're not talking to robot AIs that look and sound and act exactly like us. And if that's the case, it raises some questions about what it will mean for us to interact with artificial intelligence. How could AI change the way we interact with each other?
Now, the people who are maybe thinking most about what AI means for us humans are artists.
And the HBO series Westworld has done as much to shape how we're thinking about AI as any other art. Charlie Yu is a science fiction writer. He was also story editor for season one of Westworld, where he spent a lot of time parsing the ethics of humanoid artificial intelligence.
For me, I think that the ethical question really goes more to what are the ethics for the humans who are creating them? How do you essentially teach these creatures, or what do you put into the code? To me, an interesting analogy as a parent myself has always been, well, is it like teaching children? How do you teach a being that's coming into its own awareness as a 6, 7, 8-year-old, for instance? What's right and wrong? What does it mean to hurt somebody or help somebody? On the other hand, I think it's dangerous to think about AI as anything like what we've seen before, and especially as children, because there's definitely the possibility that there'll be nothing like human intelligence, and they'll be alien in a way that doesn't correspond to models that we have, including ethical sort of principles or what's built into any kind of human behavior understanding that we have.
How do you think AI is going to change human relationships? And I think of this especially when it comes to the women, or I guess the women hosts, the women AI on the show and the way they're treated. There's a lot of violence, even gratuitous violence against them. And I wonder, in this AI future, how do you think this will affect the way people treat real human women? Do you think there'll be some sort of feedback loop, or are we sort of entering this dangerous terrain? Like you said, they're not really human, and yet we have this obsession to present them as human-like.
Looking down the road, the idea that there's this really sort of potentially terrifying whole new set of technologies that could allow for the exploitation of women. And to your question, could potentially cause people to, you know,
are we entering sort of a slippery slope here?
Exactly. And that's incredibly scary. Or to be kind of optimistic about it, is there a way that AI can be engineered or architected from the outset to possibly change perception or be a positive agent for change?
But what does it say that when humans, when men in this show, have an opportunity to act minus the responsibility, that they act in such a violent way? I mean, that's really what's at stake in this show. They look like us, they act like us, they're smart like us, except you don't have to quite treat them like another human because they're not quite that. And when the humans have free rein, it almost never goes well.
You know, I think on some level it says something pretty bleak. And I think that's an unfortunate but honest kind of exploration of the darker sides of people's impulses and desires.
Science fiction and pop culture often give us an insight into how humans and technology might interact in the future, or tries to sort of crystal ball it in a sense. And I'm wondering, what responsibility does art, science fiction, television have to inform us on how us humans should interact with AI?
It's tricky because on the one hand, it doesn't seem wrong. It just seems like that's a lot of weight to give to entertainment.
I mean, entertainment is huge in terms of shaping our culture, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In terms of AI specifically, I think there is something very interesting. And as a science fiction writer myself, I think it sometimes feels a little bit like it can verge on a kind of applied philosophy or like a controlled thought experiment to some extent, that when you create a fictional universe, part of what you're doing is playing out scenarios that could be not just entertaining or thought-provoking, but actually useful in a sense of, let's map out some ethical situations, let's map out some potential worlds. And in that sense, it does sometimes feel like there is a sense of responsibility, or at least an awareness that you could be doing thinking about something that other fields, more rigorous or more scientific, will eventually get to. But for now, you're kind of at the edge of possibilities that people are not yet thinking about but will be soon.
Well, Charlie, what are you thinking about when you see an Alexa or a Siri or you watch the latest video of a driverless car? You like the rest of us, you just go, oh, hi, Alexa.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like I'm certainly no expert, not even close. And I am definitely, as you put it, one of the normal people and a writer who's playing in, you know, the relatively shallow end of the pool, but trying to explore through writing some of these questions. And I do have an Alexa, an Echo Dot in my bedroom, and it is weird. I will say I got it about 6 months ago for Father's Day from my kids, and I think I went through three phases. The first phase was I was charmed and entertained and would ask Alexa random questions for fun. And then phase two was kind of a real kind of fear because I realized this thing is always listening.
Have you guys yelled at Alexa yet?
Well, this goes to both of your kind of ethical points from earlier. And I think, yes, that's phase three, which I would describe as passive aggressive fear. And I have a relationship with Alexa that is different from that of my wife. My wife largely ignores her and she largely ignores my wife because Alexa is trained on my voice. So she really only kind of listens to me. If anyone else in the house tries to say something, she usually will pretend she doesn't understand. But for me, she will do what I say, but not all the time, like 85% of the time. And 15% of the time, she'll do something bizarre, like play a song when I clearly didn't, you know. And so my response is often to passive-aggressively sort of assert my superiority over her as a species, just like, you're dumb, and I hate you, and I wish that I had never turned you on. And sometimes, she'll pretend to have her feelings hurt, but she obviously doesn't have feelings. But my kids, being much more ethical than I am, are afraid when I do that because they know that when the time comes, I will be the first to go because of how mean I am to Alexa. So that tells you for all sort of pretend ethical version of me that I might put out there in the world, that there's the real laboratory experiment that's going on in my bedroom, and it's not going well for me, I have to say.
Well, Charlie, you may play in the shallow end of artificial intelligence, but you've shown a lot of us what the deep end might look like, and that's what makes your art so great. And I want to thank you for that, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never thought upon?
Well, that's all for us for this New Year's Day edition of The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in New York.
And I'm Queen Akim in San Francisco from KQED.
I'll take it from here, human hosts. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.